Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Ryan Bank, in for Melissa Ross, who's on vacation this week. We're always live at 9, and make sure to subscribe to our podcasts on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, there's more than 112,000 acres of land that one conservation group says is in critical need of preservation across Baker, Clay, Duval, Flagler, Putnam, and St. John's County. The estimated cost of purchasing the acreage is $216 million. The North Florida Land Trust is creating a call to action to help pay for what it calls its preservation portfolio. You can join our conversation today at 549-2937. Then later, the Military Museum of North Florida in Green Cove Springs has exhibits detailing U.S. military activity from the American Revolution to Operation Iraqi Freedom. But the museum operators are trying to add to that repertoire by creating its first exhibit solely devoted to the history of military women. Plus, we'll laugh with St. Augustine humor columnist Brian Thompson and talk his national recognition. I'll also chat with the mage of After Hours Music, WJCT Music Director David Luckin. All of that and more ahead. But first this hour, the North Florida Land Trust is launching yet another ambitious project to conserve more land in North Florida. The group's planning to create a 112,000-acre preservation portfolio that includes territory all around the First Coast and beyond in seven different counties. But the project, of course, doesn't come without a high cost. The Land Trust needs to raise more than $215 million for the purchase. Here to talk about this is North Florida Land Trust Executive Director Jim McCarthy. Jim, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Ryan. Good to see you again.
Good to see you. You can join our conversation today at 549-2937. What questions do you have for Jim McCarthy and the Florida Land Trust, or North Florida Land Trust, excuse me? Okay, Jim. So what is this preservation portfolio, and how does this fit into the Land Trust's existing work?
Sure, no problem. You might remember a year or so ago, we released our Strategic Conservation Priorities Plan. And basically, we looked at all 3 million acres in our 7-county focus area and said, generally speaking, these are our important venues, our important avenue or places where we ought to protect. But it was a 50,000-foot view, if you will. Now what we've done is a year later, it's been a year in the making actually, we've created the preservation portfolio where we drilled down a little bit more and we said, using those same 26 criteria, what are the critical areas that we need to preserve? Where are the most critical in the 7-county area? And we've identified 112,000. There's really kind of three points to this, but the most important is, from an environmental standpoint, there's 112,000 acres of land that are critically in need of being saved, preserved for environmental purposes.
And so for some of our listeners that may not know, can you just quickly explain what exactly or how exactly the North Florida Land Trust preserves land and what it does with the land that gets purchased?
Thank you. We are a 501c3, a private organization, community-based with a community board of directors, and we acquire property either through acquisition or donation, and we then hold easements on that land, or we actually own it and hold it in fee. Or own the land, as most people would know it. That would be our approach to how we'd solve this particular problem, is hopefully we can do it with easements rather than in fee, because it would lower the cost and allow the private landowner to continue to operate on his land. But we can get into that perhaps a little bit later.
Right. Well, so for this preservation portfolio that you have a really nice color copy here that I wish our listeners could actually see right now. But for this preservation portfolio, how did you come up with that more than $200 million number?
Well, a fairly standard real estate practice is to take the appraised value of the property and add 35% to it. And that generally gives you roughly the selling point or selling price. And so we, using that method, we came up with that particular number because we've been able to identify each and every parcel and, frankly, each and every landowner that has that property. And so we just ran the numbers, quite frankly, and a time-consuming process.
Right, I can imagine. So about the landowners, is there a cross-section of types of landowners here? Are we looking at farmers or ranchers, or who owns this land, and how do you convince them to part with it?
It is, in fact, a cross-section. It's a little bit of everything. There are some hunt camps, fishing camps. There are some farms, working ranchers. And they don't necessarily need to part with their land, hence the reference to conservation easements. They can actually continue to control and operate their farms and their ranches on their property, and they continue to own that property.
But they can't develop it, right?
That's correct. They give up their development rights to it, and that's what saves us from the environmental perspective. We'd also, in this particular case, be conscious of runoff into the creeks and rivers. You'll find that most of the preservation portfolio areas are along creeks and rivers. That's logical if you think about it.
Right.
And so for clean water purposes, for example, we would ask farmers to not graze within 100 yards of a creek or not fertilize within 100 yards of a creek, in addition to giving up their development rights. But they continue to own the property. They can continue to harvest. They can continue to timber. There's some timberland that's part of that preservation as well. So they can continue any and all of their activities.
And we're taking your calls here about the North Florida Land Trust preservation portfolio. It's pushed to try to purchase and preserve more than 112,000 acres of land in North Florida. Jim, how do you make the pitch to these landowners? Because, as you said, they don't have to give up ownership of the land, but they do have to agree to certain rules if you're going to go the easement route.
Yes.
What kind of pitch do you make to them?
Well, there's two ways of approaching a landowner, particularly on the easement side. One is that there are significant tax advantages. If it's a working ranch or farm, they are entitled to 100%. They reduce their adjusted gross income by 100% of the value of that conservation easement with a carry forward for 15 years. That can be significant and provide a real incentive for ranchers and farmers in particular. For folks who are not ranchers and farmers, they can reduce their adjusted gross income by up to 50% with a 15-year carry forward. So there are significant tax advantages if they were to donate. On the other side, we can also purchase conservation easements. The Rural and Family Lands Program is probably one of the better ones in the state of Florida that does have some funding in it, actually, to acquire conservation easements. The Mildrum property that was just done in St. Johns County is a good example of that. It was funded and purchased through the Family and Rural Lands Program, and it was about a 5,000-acre plot that the Mildrum family will continue to own and continue to timber.
All right. Well, before we go to our calls, I do also want to ask, have you already been in contact with the landowners that are involved in this preservation portfolio?
Not within the preservation portfolio. That was what was really interesting to us, is that this has been an unusual job for me. It's one of those where you know what your mission is, and everybody keeps saying, where are you headed? Where are you headed? And that was one of the reasons we focused on the strategic plan and now the preservation portfolio, is to really focus on where we're headed. And we've been talking to a number of landowners. And by the way, they're all willing landowners. We cannot practice eminent domain. We can't take anybody's property. We don't do that. So we deal with willing folks. But the folks that we have been dealing with are outside of the preservation portfolio. Now, having said that, one of the pieces that would have been in the preservation portfolio was the 2,551 acres we acquired in the Nassau River last year.
Right.
That would have been in the preservation portfolio had we not already acquired it. So we have some land, and all of the land that we own on Big Talbot Island would be in this portfolio, except that we already own it. So this is an approach of what land we have not purchased or acquired yet, or is not preserved by anybody else.
All right, and we'll get back to that, but I do want to take some calls here. Jeff in Mandarin, you're on the air.
Good morning. Hey, thanks
good morning.
For doing this. I think it's a great thing. I've got two questions. One, have you ever considered carbon capture on the land that you've acquired, like planting trees and just letting them go as carbon, as an additional either income stream for the property or as a tax benefit for the 503C? And then two, do you have a minimum size parcel of land that you'll acquire? I've got a residential piece of property that my house burned down on, and we're trying to figure out what to do with the land, and it might be worthwhile to do that. It's only like 4.5 acres, though. So is there a minimum size that you go with, and have you ever considered just using them as carbon capture?
Well,
thank you for your call, Jeff.
And I thank you as well. Good questions on both parts. The answer to your question is the IRS looks at conservation easements very carefully, and we want to be very careful for our clients. And so we really don't look to do easements or under 40 acres. That seems to be a trigger for the IRS. And so 40 acres is kind of our minimum. Although there could be exceptions to that if it was incredibly valuable, particularly environmental land or ecological land.
Or even historical, right?
Or even historical.
Like the Spanish-American War Fort.
Like the Spanish-American War Fort. That's correct, which we're acquiring for different reasons than these. But nonetheless, if it's got significant value to it, we'd like to talk to you about it. But generally speaking, looking at 40 acres or more. In terms of the carbon credits, yes, we are definitely looking at that. One of the hopes that we have in order to fund this is that we would find some businesses that perhaps want to reduce their carbon footprint, that would want to contribute to a fund to be able to help us acquire this property and therefore reduce their carbon footprint. We did take into account the carbon reduction as part of our ecosystem benefits. The second part of the study was that we identified the 112,000 acres, and then we went a second step, and we identified the ecosystem benefits. Basically, those are the benefits that nature provides us for free, but it is things like carbon reduction, oxygen production, fisheries, habitat, wildlife habitat, flood prevention, those kinds of things, and it can have a certain economic value associated with them. And then we went to a step three and figured out, okay, if we have the X number of acres and we have Y number of ecosystem benefits, what's a return on an investment? Which is a little different approach, which should make some of the business folks happy and some of our more conservative friends happy in the context that they can then look at a return on an investment and see that the entire portfolio pays for itself.
It's an ecological economy.
An ecological economy, or as one state representative asked me last year, we sure would like to see the economics of conservation.
Right.
Well, here they are. We know that the return on the investment, if we were to acquire all 200,000 acres, is in 5 or 6 months. And that's an annual return on their investment, because once we secure that property, either through easement or through ownership, those ecosystem benefits continue annually. So it's a huge win. And oh, by the way, as a kind of a sideline on that same subject, I've also taken some heat, I guess would be a good word, from folks who say, gee, we have enough property that's we can't afford to put any more property off the tax rolls. Well, here's your option. You either receive the ecosystem benefits that nature is providing you naturally, or you start paying hundreds of millions of dollars for stormwater treatment facilities or wastewater treatment facilities.
So you're saying it's the age-old debate of benefits up front or benefits in the long run?
Correct.
Well, I want to go to another call here, and we'll get back to the ecological economy and all the other things that we were talking about. But Bill in San Marco, Bill, you're on the air.
Hi, and thank you for taking my call.
Thank you for calling.
I really wanted to sing the praises of this organization. You know, this is a community-based, non-governmental organization. I think what I like about the Land Trust is it's the people of Florida doing conservation themselves. And I think many of us underestimate the value of natural beauty and clean water and all the things land preservation can bring to our quality of life and how it improves our economy. So just calling to compliment, I think this is probably the most dynamic private conservation organization in the state. So wonderful to have you here and working for us.
Well, thank you very much, Bill. I really appreciate it. We probably put you on our PR staff here fairly soon. Thank you.
Thanks for your call, Bill. All right, so I want to kind of get into the brass tacks here.
Yeah.
How exactly are you planning to pay for this land. A couple hundred million dollars. It's not just change.
Yeah, I don't have it in my bank account.
You can't find it in the sofa.
That's correct. That's very true. I think there's a couple of different ways. We would certainly hope that some individuals would step forward who are interested in making a significant donation. That's certainly part of it. There is the hope that corporations would, in fact, donate, perhaps just for the environmental reasons. The other reason they might is because they want to reduce their carbon footprint, or they want to contribute to a green fund and be considered green in a growing trend. I mean, it would be great to see various Jacksonville-based companies proceeding along that lines. So that's certainly one option. The other one is to look at donations. We're hoping, or donations of land. And that would be our first approach with the homeowner or the landowners. And then obviously the cost of acquisition, we would still look to the government. We would probably look to the state first, although we all know the status of Amendment 1. And that's
still tied up. There's a lawsuit right now tied up in Leon County Circuit Court. I want to get back to that, and I want to get back to the issue of the landowners and talking to them. But we have another call. Melissa in Clay County. Melissa, you're on the air.
Hi. I was wondering how much of your operating budget is devoted to monitoring the lands that you own or intend to own, and how much of it is devoted to administrative costs? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Melissa.
Well, thank you. I'm trying to do quick calculations in my mind. I can see
the wheels turning.
Yeah, exactly. They move slowly, but we'll get there. We have about a $600,000 operating budget currently. We employ 8 people, 2 of which are on the land protection side, which is largely our acquisition folks. And then we have 2 people in our stewardship side, those people that manage the land. And I guess if you – and then we have an outreach person as well. So it's I would say about a third of that budget is focused on the management. It's incredibly important to us, particularly as we acquire more land. It's very important that we do so. And as a percentage, I was just looking at this because we're in the process of finalizing our audit, and about 83% last year went to programming rather than administrative costs. And the reason the administrative costs, quite frankly, were so high is that we're growing in order to keep pace with the growth that we're undertaking and the land that we're acquiring. That should level off. And projecting forward into 2016, I think by this time next year, we'll probably be back up around 89-90% again.
Wow. So I want to get back to the question of the landowners. You had mentioned that for the most part, you haven't actually spoken to these landowners yet.
Correct.
Do you think that there might be it might make it more difficult announcing this preservation portfolio? I mean, what if one of these landowners comes up on this portfolio and says, "Hey, that's my land. And maybe they would feel like they should have gotten a call before.
Yeah. Do I think that's a problem? Perhaps. What we're found, I had a conversation just this week with a county commissioner in St. John's County, and he actually knows of people who want to do this. They just hadn't been approached yet. And they happen to be in our preservation portfolio areas. So for them, it's going to be welcome to have somebody approach them and say, you know, we're interested. I think we're going to find more of that than we are the other. I'm certainly hopeful of it.
Right. Of course. Yeah. So we're taking your calls on the North Florida Land Trust's preservation portfolio. It's more than 112,000 acres. It intends to purchase and preserve. Please give us a call and let us know your thoughts at 549-2937. So going back to paying for this land,
yes.
You mentioned very briefly state funds.
Yes.
And we know that since 2014, when voters overwhelmingly voted for Amendment 1, which devoted a certain percentage of the documentary stamp tax funds to a dedicated land acquisition trust fund to purchase more land, and we've seen a lot of controversy over how those funds can be used.
Yes.
Right now, there's a lawsuit working through its way through the courts right now with the Florida Wildlife Federation, a couple of other green NGOs, environmental or conservationists. What is your hope that the North Florida Land Trust, which a large organization to be sure, but smaller than, let's say, Sierra Club of Florida or the FWF or any of these others, what are the chances that, or I guess, how much are you depending on getting any of that state funds, any of those state funds?
Depending, we're highly dependent upon them. How likely we think that they're going to come is a different story based on the last 2 years. As you know, most of that money out of Amendment 1 has been diverted to other projects that are totally unrelated to the intentions of Amendment 1.
A little more than half of the funds have gone to the administration of
correct.
They're the paying DEP and things of that nature.
They're paying for salaries
water
for
projects.
That's correct. They're paying for salaries of DEP employees and buying fire trucks and paying for insurance policies to defend certain folks from civil rights suits and the state employees from civil rights suits.
But some would argue that these water projects and these other things that they're spending on are within, lawmakers would argue that it's within the purview of the amendment, and that the state of Florida already has one of the most robust preservation programs in the country.
And I understand that, and I've heard that argument. I guess there's a couple of different things to say. One is that, yes, some of the money is going to acquisition of environmentally sensitive lands, particularly the Everglades and certain springs. So that's $300 million.
Right, we've seen some pretty historic funding for the Everglades recently.
Which is wonderful. Let me point out to you, however, particularly for our listeners here, that makes us a donor counties. And that that money's coming from dock stamps, and those take place obviously at closing when people buy real estate. In the fastest growing part of the state, we are now producing more dock stamp money and sending it to Tallahassee. That dock stamp money is now not coming back to our area, to any of the seven counties. Mm-hmm. It's going down to the Everglades to help U.S. Sugar buy that property from U.S. Sugar. That's not the answer to solving Amendment 1. That's not why 75% of it voted for Amendment 1. We should have $800,000, roughly, in that fund, not $300,000. And we should be getting some of it here in Northeast Florida.
$800 million, right?
I'm sorry, $800 yeah. million.
That's all
right. And instead, we've got $300 million going down. And that's the responsibility of our state legislatures, is to get that money up here. And there are good projects here to do that. As a local commissioner pointed out to me, one good year of Amendment 1, we could have this entire portfolio done. I mean, that's just amazing to me. Now, I know there's other needs in the state, and I understand how that works. But given a couple of years of full funding of Amendment 1, we could have this. And in terms of how much the robust preservation that we've already undertaken, I would agree with that. But again, you go back to the ecosystem benefits. There are benefits from acquiring this property for us in terms of the taxpayer. Are you going to spend it to acquire this property to get what nature normally provides for you, or are you going to build stormwater and wastewater treatment plants? And that's really your answer in the long run.
All right. We've got lots of calls. I want to go to a few of your calls right now. Jeff in Jacksonville, you have a question for Jim? Jeff?
Hi, I was wondering, since you guys are highly dependent on public funds, are you subject to Florida's public records law and the Sunshine Law with your meetings?
We are not subject to the Sunshine Laws. However, our meetings are open. Our land committee meetings are open to the public, and we'd welcome input from the community. And they meet on the third Tuesday of every even month. And I say that meaning February and April and June. And they meet to discuss our acquisition plans and get recommendations. Our board meetings are for our board. And because we get deals so heavily in real estate transactions, they are closed. But the other meetings, the land protection meetings, are open. And we'd welcome you to attend.
Thanks for the call, Jeff. And we'll go now to Jim in Orange Park. You're on the air.
One of your employees, Jennifer Fletcher, has us donating our free time to help you guys out. And we're out at the Spanish Fort. I was just wondering, where do we stand with that? Thank you.
Well, thank you for the question, Jim.
I told you we'd get to it eventually.
Yeah, I know. It's a good thing. I still keep calling him mayor, although he's now a city councilman, Hazuri, has introduced a piece of legislation for city council consideration that would provide us with $162,500 towards our acquisition. That would put us about $78,000 shy of this $400,000 that we're attempting to raise to purchase that fort. We've still got a few more months to do that. We're hopeful. Hazuri is joined by Councilman Ferraro and Councilman Cressenbeny in supporting the bill, and I understand Councilman Love is on board. So if we get six more, we'll have ourselves $162,500 to go along with about the $59,000 we've raised, and the Dolores Barr Weaver Fund has offered the $100,000 grant. So we're getting closer and could sure use some more help, particularly from large donors. But 134 individuals have stepped forward and sent us anywhere from $5 to $2,500, and we're just thrilled to have every one of them.
And we're running out of time here, but I do want to take a last call here from Lindsay in Arlington. Lindsay, you're on the air.
Good morning, and that was really going to be one of my questions as well with regard to the Spanish-American War battlements there. Jim, are there any fundraising efforts that we can be involved with to help bridge that gap for the last 78,000?
Well, Lindsay, we're going to hold a luncheon the end of July, first part of August, we're looking at with some individuals. If you want to contact our office, we'd be glad to send you an invitation to that. We're particularly hoping to get some potentially large donors to it, and we're also hoping that they might be able to refer us to some donors who might be interested in donating to this particular project.
Thanks for your call, Lindsay. So to end off here, what is the timeline for getting this preservation portfolio purchased and preserved?
Well, at the moment, we're just beginning our outreach efforts. We've targeted a couple of the different corridors, if you will, or priority areas, and said, okay, let's take a look at those and let's focus reaching out to a manageable number of homeowners, landowners, and engaging their reactions. So we're beginning the process now. I think this is a long-term project. Unless we can get Amendment 1 money, unless we can get Land and Water Conservation Fund money out of the U.S. government, unless we can, you know, we get huge donors to come forward, unless we get corporations to want to be reduce their carbon footprint, once we raise that money, we'll go forward. And otherwise, it's a long play for us. I would anticipate it's a 5-year project, but hopefully we can accomplish it quickly, knowing that Duval County is about to be built out, and St. John's is rapidly growing. And Clay's not far behind, particularly with the First Coast Expressway coming through.
Right, right. Well, Jim McCarthy is the executive director of the North Florida Land Trust on talking about their preservation portfolio. Jim, thanks for being here. Always a pleasure.
Thank you, Ryan.
Much more still ahead. Later in the hour, we'll play St. Augustine humor columnist Brian Thompson's award-winning commentary and chat with the writer. We'll also spin some new music with WJCT's David Luckin. But up next, the North Florida Military Museum is looking to expand its own portfolio to include an entire exhibit devoted to women in the service. We'll be right back.
This Going Green segment is brought to you by the Unitarian Universalist Church of Jacksonville.
I wouldn't know that Jacksonville was two different worlds if I didn't work here, probably, and see this stuff all the time. But I think a lot of people just don't know so much of this city is in such bad shape. For so long, the owners of these properties, for example, there's just no light shining on them. So why would they do anything different?
WJCT's series on housing and poverty, Chasing the Dream, airs all this week on Morning Edition. Funding for Chasing the Dream is provided by the JPB Foundation and the Ford Foundation.
On the next Fresh Air, how the FBI identifies and tracks those on the terrorism watch list, and why the killer in the Orlando nightclub massacre had been taken off the list. We talk with Eric Lischblau of the New York Times. He shared a Pulitzer Prize for breaking the story of the NSA's wiretapping program. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Hello, I'm Mayor Lenny Curry. It's hurricane season. Are you Jacks ready? Learn more about how you can keep yourselves and your family safe during a storm. Download the 2016-2017 City of Jacksonville Preparedness Guide today at jacksready.com and tune in to 89.9, the area's official emergency broadcast station.
Markets, the theory goes, play no favorites. Theories, however, are just that.
The system's rigged, and it's to my benefit. I don't think that's a good thing, but it is.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Americans feeling not so great about the economy. The Marketplace Edison Research Poll, next time on the program.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back to First Coast Connect. I'm Ryan Bank, filling in for Melissa Ross. The Military Museum of North Florida has artifacts from just about every U.S. military conflict you can think of. World War II? Yeah. Korea? Vietnam? World War I? Check, check, and check. But what the museum really wants now is to create an exhibit solely devoted to military women. The museum's Chris Rodatz is here to talk about that push. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm always more than happy to talk about the museum.
Well, thank you for being here. So before I get into this new exhibit, I wanted you to start off by telling me a little bit about the museum. Give me a quick history and when it got started and all that.
Okay. The museum was formed in 2008. It's had several locations, and for the last 4 or 5 years, we've been at Reynolds Industrial Park in Green Cove Springs, which is the old Navy Auxiliary Air Station, Green Cove Springs, of World War II fame. And Reynolds Industrial Park was kind enough to give us an old World War II Quonset hut, and that is basically our headquarters where all the exhibits are. What you have to understand is that Naval Auxiliary Air Station Green Cove Springs is quite a historic place. Basically, that's where General Roy Geiger, the father of Marine Corps Aviation, flew in and out of. It was the main training base for the F-6F Hellcat, which was the Navy's top zero killer in World War II, and a whole myriad of other things that happened out at that base. And after the war, it was also the home of the Atlantic Mothball Fleet. At one time, there were 600 ships there. So it's a pretty historic place. The museum is basically the only privately held military museum, I believe, in the North Florida area. We're a 501(c)(3) corporation. We're manned totally by volunteers. We only have one paid employee, which is our bookkeeper.
Keeps us straight. That brings up another question I had. I've been there once before, and I wanted to know how exactly is the museum funded, and where do you get all these great artifacts? Where do they come from?
The artifacts basically come from donors, people who want to donate to the museum, or in some cases where they lend us. And some of our vehicles are lent to us, the old military vehicles. We have a variety of those. But now what we're leaning more towards straight-out donations. So in the event that we have to dispose of equipment or we get duplicates, you know, we're able to do that. Whereas if it's just loaned to us, then basically there's some controls on as to what we can do.
So the museum is trying to create this new exhibit devoted to women.
Yes.
But it already has a lot of artifacts highlighting women's role in these conflicts, correct?
Yeah, yes. What has happened with the museum here, and partially in, I would say, well, mainly in the last year to year and a half, where we've totally revamped the organization of the museum, we've decided to get more specific on some of our exhibits. We have tons and tons of stuff that people have donated. And, you know, some of these things are just, the obvious things are there. We've got the Revolutionary War exhibits. We've got World War II, you know, as Ryan said, and, you know, through all the wars and stuff like that. But now we're at a point where we want to kind of pinpoint things. One of the things we're going to go after this coming year, or for the balance of this year, really, is the women in combat, or just the women in the military exhibit. That'll go all the way back to the Revolutionary War through the present time. You know, we're also doing another one, which is for the F-6F Hellcat. We're digging one out of the swamps right now that's still a crashed engine that's still out there.
Where is it?
It's on the peripheries of Reynolds Industrial Park.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and if it ever stops raining long enough, we may be able to get it out. We're also developing a curriculum for the schools in Clay County or anybody else who wants us for K through 12 for history, military history.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit more about that. What kind of educational programs do you already offer?
Well, we've been doing these off and on as requested by the various and sundry history instructors or Naval ROTC instructors, you know, where we send a volunteer who's well-versed in whatever the subject matter is, into the schools and talks to the kids.
Do they bring in any of the artifacts to show?
We bring in the artifacts, whatever they want us to do. However, we've decided to formalize it a little bit more because, as most people know, history is pretty much an ignored subject in schools these days. And consequently, we feel that particularly the military heritage, not only a nationwide, but particularly in Northeast Florida, our military, we've got tremendous military heritage here, and it's largely being ignored, and the kids don't know what's out there.
Well, we recently just spoke to Jim McCarthy from the North Florida Land Trust, and if they're able to acquire the Spanish-American War Fort,
we're looking
at a base or a fort from each conflict Florida has been directly involved in.
Correct.
In the United States history, we have everything.
I think that needs to be emphasized to the young people out there because, like I say, they don't know. My wife is a former Clay County school teacher, and she still substitute teaches at times. And, she talks to the kids. And some of you got kids out there, they don't even know what the 4th of July is about. They know it's a holiday, but that's about it.
So burgers and hot dogs.
Burgers and hot dogs. You got that. And go to the beach. The whole point of the 4th of July is kind of lost on them because it was not taught in schools.
So how do you make this history? You know, people have this idea. I've always enjoyed history, but people have this idea that history is something that happened in the past, or you can have people that are skeptical that it can be cool. How do you reach those kids? You know, do you tailor these educational programs in a specific way?
We try to tailor them. Now, I would tell you this, that this is still a work in progress. We're putting together formal curriculums right now. But really, when you go into the kids, they've got to be able to touch and feel. You've got to bring the exhibits in. Let them feel the uniforms. Let them feel some of the old weapons, the vehicles, if that's possible. More importantly, what we try to do is, in a classroom, you can give them a broad brush of it with a PowerPoint, presentation or what have you. But you really want to get them to the museum. That's when they really can touch and feel and get a sense for what it's all about.
So really quickly, before I let you go, how can people get involved to help get this new exhibit off the ground?
People should email us at the Military Museum North Florida at AOL.com. Our website is currently down. We're in the process of rebuilding it. But it'll be up shortly. Or people can come out from Wednesday through Sunday to the museum and talk to us. If anybody has any major artifacts, as in regard to the women's exhibit, and let me just throw this in real fast. We had a lady at when we did our Armed Forces Day presentation who turns out was one of what's known as a Rosie the Riveter That's the women who supported the men during World War II by doing things on the home front. And this lady actually worked on the airplanes at NAS Jax putting in navigational and communications equipment. Just a wonderful person. And it's just really interesting to hear her slant on what she contributed to the war. So that's what this exhibit is going to cover.
All right. Well, thanks for being here, Chris, and good luck on the new exhibit.
Okay.
Coming up after the break, we'll chat with St. Augustine columnist Brian Thompson about his national award. Back in a moment with more First Coast Connect.
In an abusive situation, many people call the police. For one Pennsylvania mother, that wasn't an option.
I'd rather them find me on the street than find me at my house like this, because I'm going to get put out if the cops come here.
Choosing between abuse and eviction later on All Things Considered from NPR News. Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
WJCT and Baptist Health invite you to Girls Day Out, Saturday, September 17th at the Hyatt Hotel. Enjoy breakfast, lunch, great speakers, including celebrity chef My Fam, and Good Morning America host and breast cancer survivor Amy Robach. Tickets are $40. Log on to wjct.org/girlsdayout.
Welcome back to First Coast Connect. I'm Ryan Bank in for Melissa Ross, who's on vacation this week. Brian Thompson's column, Life in a Nutshell, is this year's second place winner in the National Society of Newspaper Columnists annual column contest. Longtime First Coast Connect listeners might remember Thompson's commentaries that aired a few years back on this show. Now he's back with one of his winning columns. This piece about his family's trip to Disney World originally ran in the St. Augustine Record.
Some people dream of riding rocket ships, climbing to the top of Mount Everest, traveling to far-off lands where they teach remote villages how to play Candy Crush on their iPhones. Then there is me. My dream? Much more epic. To arrive with my family at Disney World just as the park opens, allowing us to scamper about, deliriously riding whatever we want while unimpeded by crowds. In my fantasy land, we do everything in the park twice before most people get off the parking lot trams. There's a parade for us, triumphant music plays, park management declares we have broken a Guinness record for accomplishing 220 rides before 9 a.m. They give us each a medal and we recover in the medical tent while hooked up to IVs. This is my dream. Last weekend, I came as close to accomplishing this as I've ever been. It wasn't easy. To make it happen, I had to make a spiritual journey. I had to go to another place where I was transformed into a new person. I call him Lunatic Dad. Lunatic Dad rises before the crack of dawn, drinks about $45 worth of Starbucks coffee, and then proceeds to march about the hotel room, screaming like a drill sergeant. People, do you have no respect for yourselves? Do you think Small World will come to your pretty little behinds? Do you think the 15 million people going to Disney are going to let you waltz up to the teacups? Lunatic Dad stomps and taps his watch and sighs heavily when people take on unnecessary tasks like breakfast or brushing teeth or putting on sunscreen. Lunatic Dad breaks the sound barrier driving to the park and thinks that if he concentrates hard enough, maybe blows a blood vessel while holding his breath, the monorail line will go faster. And once Lunatic Dad makes it into Disney, as close to the opening time as he can, he doesn't shut up about it. See, he says, while racing from empty ride to empty ride, this is what we trained for. This is what victory tastes like. I am Lunatic Dad. An hour in and we already had 8 rides under our belt. 8 rides. I don't remember any of them. It was a blur. We were all exhausted, looking like we had hiked across a great desert. Dehydrated, depleted, ready to go back to the hotel. But in my dream world, we had tasted success. Maybe it's time for a new dream. Maybe it's time to slow down, to retire Lunatic Dad, and then find a remote village needing to learn how to play iPhone video games. Or maybe, maybe we can get there just a little earlier next year.
Brian Thompson joins us now by phone from St. Augustine. Brian, good morning.
Ryan, good morning. Thank you. Thank you for having me. And I hope I don't lower the IQ level too much of your listenership today. We hear all this serious stuff on all morning, and then there's me talking about Disney World and getting hooked up to IVs.
You know, I think it's refreshing, Brian. Honestly, this is...
It's something. I don't know about refreshing, but it's something. I'm sorry.
That's all right. I absolutely love this commentary. How did you come up with Lunatic Dad? I mean, is this based off of your own life experiences?
Yeah, it's me. Ask my daughter, my 10-year-old daughter, and she'll say, yeah, that's him. you know, it's all about experiences. That's what my column is. I don't, you know, I call it a humor column, but that's tough because, you know, you say that, and then the next thing somebody says will say something funny, you know, and you just go, I don't know, rutabaga, what do you say? But I don't tell jokes, I tell experiences, and I think you look around, and we all have these experiences, and they're just laugh out loud, hysterical, we're crazy people ourselves, and I just get to, thanks to the St. Augustine Record, I just get the opportunity to share them, and it's wonderful.
You know, I was sitting here nodding my head the entire time because I saw a little bit of my father and a little bit of myself in Lunatic Dad, trying to get to the park early, and you have like this crazy itinerary, you're trying to get on all the rides, and you have like this strategic plan.
it's kind of sad, really, as I listen to it. And coincidentally, we're going down to Orlando, and I'm going to Disney tomorrow, and I'm just thinking to myself, please, man, don't do that again. Let's just be normal. What's wrong with you?
I mean, do you make it a self-fulfilling prophecy if you put it on paper?
In some ways, you know, and I always say that honestly, the column is more like therapy for me, you know, and I think that's been kind of my thing. You know, you laugh to keep from crying, and so you just have things happen to you in life, and it's good. You know, people relate to it, and you kind of try to find these universal things, and I think that's the beauty of humor. It's just finding these things that other people can connect with also.
Right. Were you surprised by this national award?
Yeah, I can't believe you give awards for things like this. You know? So, I don't know why you do that. But you know, it's something I've been entering for a number of years. I've won Florida Press Club awards before, but this is obviously on another level. And it's just exciting, you know, again, to be able to tell stories. It's fun too. You know, you're writing these pieces about your family, about your daughter, and to get recognized for that, it's really exciting.
All right, Brian. Well, congratulations on your award, and I wish you continued success. Thanks for being here, and
awesome.
Thanks for being funny.
Thank you for having me. Back to the serious stuff.
All right, and now we're joined by WJCT's own music guru, David Luckin.
Hi, Ryan. Good morning.
We're here to talk about music, of course. Tell me a little bit about what the lineup you have for tonight.
Well, our good friends in Brooklyn, New York, from Cosign, who do promotion, marketing, and licensing, send me great new music every day. And tonight, the first hour is all new music. And we start with Kendra Morris. Her new album is called Babel. And this is a kid, Ryan, who grew up listening to her parents' record collection of 60s and 70s early soul and funk.
And you showed me that, and I said it immediately. I was like, Pink Floyd, you know.
Here's a little bit of her. We don't have a lot of time, but a little bit.
Yeah.
Twist and burn how you turn me on. Let's go south where the days are long. Don't got a dollar, but I got you, friend. So let's leave tonight.
Well, you were listening to her yesterday with me, and she's kind of likes Mayer Hawthorne and Ellis Russell and Leela James. She's in that new neo-soul-funk mood. It's a really good album. We're playing about four tracks from that tonight at 9.
She's got a really, really wide range of talent here.
Yeah, and we heard some a little more funky, some a little more down-tempo. We've got another new great group I really like, and this is called Bad, Bad, Not Good. And they kind of follow the legacy of John Coltrane and Herbie Hancock's Headhunters and Flying Lotus and modern kind of jazz funk. And here's a little bit of them. Bad, bad, not good. And this album, like the other, is all over the place. There's some a little more up-tempo, some a little more down-tempo. Just really good music. I really liked this. I think I put 5 tracks in tonight's first hour. Just every track is like, play 1, play 2, play 4. Play a lot of it, because we like to, usually on Tuesdays, if I have a lot of new music I go through on the weekends, we play a lot of new music on Tuesday nights, as well as some classic, you know, reggae and down-tempo and chill and all the other great music.
Right.
Last but not least, as part of the Blue Moon Boys, do you know who the Blue Moon Boys were? That was Elvis's first group with Scotty Moore, Bill Black, and Elvis. And unfortunately, we lost Scotty Moore yesterday after all these great years. Inspired rock and rollers forever. Keith Richards from the Rolling Stones was one of those inspired by Moore. And he said, when I heard Heartbreak Hotel, I knew what I wanted to do in life. It was as plain as day. All I wanted to do in the world was to be able to play and sound like that. Everyone else wanted to be Elvis. I wanted to be Scotty. Here's a little bit of Scotty Moore from 1956. Now you know why everyone was crazy about Elvis. It was just like Elvis said, I had a guitar and a shaky leg and another guitar and another shaky leg and a bass player. And Scotty Moore was the gentleman who invited Elvis to his house in 54 and listened to him. And then Sam Phillips of Sun Records said, bring him in, let's see what he can do. And the rest is history. But Scotty Moore, a great guitar player who inspired generations of rock and roll guitar players, no doubt.
Almost impossible not to learn something new talking to you, David.
I do my best. And you're not Melissa Ross. I was told Melissa would be here. I'm very disappointed.
No, I'm sorry. I'm the bargain Melissa Ross.
Did a great job. Yeah, thanks, man.
Thanks. And that's our show. Thanks to all our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show's theme is composed and performed by Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Subscribe to our daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. And watch video on demand segments at our partner TVJax.com. I'm Ryan Bank, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. Join us again tomorrow at 9 a.m. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.